Good evening. I'm Amna Nawaz. Judy Woodruff is away. On the News Hour tonight, a tenuous peace. A ceasefire between Israel and Hamas holds, but tensions are high as both sides claim victory. Then COVID's global toll. We look at the enormous vaccine gap between rich and poor countries as the virus surges in the developing world. Plus, 1 year later, how the emotion and trauma following George Floyd's murder is finding its way into artistic expression.
There were times that I was weeping, painting the picture, and I had to take breaks. And, you know, seeing that face that large and painting it that way with that black and white was really profound to me as I painted it.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Well, the shooting has stopped, but the war of words goes on. Late today, Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas to pledge U.S. humanitarian assistance and discuss maintenance of the ceasefire. Abbas governs on the West Bank and has no authority in Gaza. Israel and Hamas, meanwhile, offered sharply different versions today of who won and who lost in this, their fourth conflict in just over a dozen years. John Yang reports on day one of the ceasefire.
Sounds of celebration replaced the echoes of artillery fire and rockets as the fragile truce largely held for its first full day. Thousands of Palestinians rallied in Gaza, declaring victory over Israel after 11 days of fighting.
This is a liberation. We won. We broke their pride. I hope God will protect the resistance.
A senior Hamas official in Gaza City had a message for Israel.
Netanyahu, the Zionist enemy, and his army said that they would destroy the tunnels above our resistance. And I tell him today that our fighters are now striding proudly in the tunnels.
Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh also thanked Iran for supplying weapons to Gaza. Hundreds of Hamas supporters marched in Khan Yunus after Friday prayers. There were also celebrations in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. At the same time, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declared his own victory.
When we embarked together on the campaign, I defined its main goal to land a hard blow on the terror organizations, to harm their capabilities and restore calm while establishing our deterrence. And that is exactly what we did.
But he also sounded a warning.
If Hamas thinks we will tolerate a drip of rockets, it is wrong. We will respond in a different power to any show of aggression against the communities surrounding Gaza or anywhere else in the state of Israel.
The truce was tested today when Palestinians threw rocks and Molotov cocktails at Israeli police outside Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Officers fired back with stun grenades. Palestinian protesters also clashed with Israeli security forces in the West Bank city of Hebron. Netanyahu is facing criticism from Israelis who say he ended the assault too soon.
I'm against the ceasefire with Gaza. I think we should continue the fighting. Continue the fighting until Hamas will collapse totally. It's only a matter of time until the next operation in Gaza.
Others welcome the calm.
Finally, there is a ceasefire. Hopefully there will be peace in the country. I'm sick of this mess. What can I say? Let there be peace.
Tens of thousands of Gazans were forced to flee their homes during the conflict. Some, like Hassan Alian, returned today for the first time to see the damage.
Look at the rubble and broken glass. Look at this ceiling. It's gone. My house was destroyed. If I had rooms built from concrete, I would have saved my kids inside them and wouldn't have fled the house.
The World Health Organization took stock of the toll on Gaza's already strained healthcare system.
We've recorded significant trauma needs, substantial fatalities and injuries are overwhelming the health facilities. 33% of essential medical supplies are at zero stock. So even if the hospitals and clinics were functioning, they wouldn't be able to provide the care and services fully anyway.
The WHO said 30 Gaza health facilities were damaged, including one that was completely leveled. The European Union also welcomed an end to the bloodshed, but insisted that only a political solution would bring lasting peace. In recent days, President Biden had stepped up pressure on Netanyahu to de-escalate the violence and Secretary of State Antony Blinken will soon head to the region. State Department spokesman Ned Price.
For the past 10 or 11 days, we've been very focused on bringing about an end to the violence, achieving a ceasefire. During the same period, we have engaged in intense planning for what comes next.
Price also acknowledged the long road that lies ahead.
No one here is under any illusions that a two-state solution, that final status negotiations are on the docket for later this week or later this month or maybe even later this year. So our goal in the meantime is to do all we can to improve lives, to build confidence, to instill opportunity and some degree of hope in the Palestinian people so that together they can work constructively with Israelis.
A goal that has frustrated so many White Houses in the past. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
In the day's other news, the World Health Organization said the true death toll from COVID-19 is likely far higher than reported. The official global figure is 3.4 million, but the agency estimates the real figure could be 6 to 8 million. We'll take a closer look at that after the news summary. The state of California says it will drop all social distancing requirements and allow full capacity for businesses starting June 15th. That announcement came today as federal health officials acknowledged that not everyone is comfortable with returning to normal. Dr. Anthony Fauci pointed to relaxed guidance on wearing masks.
As we've said with the recent CDC guidelines that say we can feel comfortable that if you're fully vaccinated, that you are safe from being infected, be it outdoors or indoors, you can understand that when people have been following a certain trend for a considerable period of time, that it may take time for them to adjust.
Also today, the Biden administration said it's partnering with popular dating apps to incentivize vaccinations. Users who get the shots will have badges added to their profiles showing their vaccination status. They'll also have access to premium content. The Attorney General of Minnesota will take over prosecuting the former police officer who killed Dante Wright. Keith Ellison announced today that his office assumed the lead role at the request of local prosecutors. Kim Potter was fired after the shooting and now faces second-degree manslaughter charges. Her lawyers say she meant to use her taser but grabbed her gun by mistake. President Biden hosted South Korean President Moon Jae-in at the White House today with North Korea topping the agenda. Moon is pushing for new diplomacy to curb nuclear efforts by the North, also known as DPRK. Mr. Biden offered his take at a joint news conference.
Our two nations also share a willingness to engage diplomatically with the DPRK, to take pragmatic steps that will reduce tensions as we move toward our ultimate goal of denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
The leaders also discussed ways of countering China's growing influence in the Pacific region. Earlier, the two presidents paid tribute to Ralph Puckett Jr., who received the Medal of Honor. During the Korean War, Puckett ran across a battlefield three times to draw fire and reveal enemy positions. His supporters campaigned for decades to get him the nation's highest military award. Puckett is now 94. At today's ceremony, the presidents flanked him for photographs and said the honor was long overdue. In Britain, the government is now reviewing oversight of the BBC after a scathing report on a 1995 interview with Princess Diana. In it, she laid bare her troubled marriage to Prince Charles and admitted to having an affair. The inquiry found journalist Martin Bashir lied to get the interview and the BBC covered up the misconduct. Diana's eldest son, Prince William, said Thursday that the interview helped lead to her death 2 years later in an auto wreck pursued by paparazzi.
The interview was a major contribution to making my parents' relationship worse and has since hurt countless others. It brings indescribable sadness to know that the BBC's failures contributed significantly to her fear, paranoia, and isolation that I remember from those final years with her.
In the wake of the report, the BBC has issued an apology to the royal family. Back in this country, shareholders in Tribune Publishing voted on selling the major newspaper chain to a hedge fund known for sweeping staff cuts. Alden Global Capital, said they approved a deal valued at $630 million, but the union representing journalists at the Chicago Tribune, Baltimore Sun, and other papers in the chain said the ballot counting was in dispute. And on Wall Street today, the stock market turned in its second losing week in a row. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 123 points today, but the NASDAQ fell 64 points, and the S&P 500 lost 3 points. Still to come on the NewsHour, Apple and Epic Games face off in a trial that could decide the future of smartphone apps. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart break down the politics of the January 6th Commission. WNBA superstar Sue Bird on the impact of the league as it marks 25 years, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
While the pandemic's toll is easing here in the U.S., it still has a firm, deadly grip on a number of other countries. The estimated global death toll from COVID-19 remains around 13,000 people a day. And the WHO's new estimates are far higher than many realize. William Brangham looks now at some of the implications.
Amna, things are indeed better in the U.S., but still, more than 600 people died from COVID-19 in America in the past 24 hours. Though in other countries, the official toll is many times higher and new infections keep climbing. India reported more than 4,200 deaths in the last day. Brazil, more than 2,400. In fact, six of the countries with the highest current death rates are in South America. And according to the WHO, that's likely a significant underestimate of the real toll, off by 3 to 4 million deaths at least. And for many of these nations, life-saving vaccines are barely available. Dr. Monica Gandhi specializes in infectious diseases and global medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Gandhi, great to have you on the program. Do you think that these WHO estimates are accurate? And if those horrible numbers are real, what does that say about the real danger we are still in from this virus?
You know, this is a very dangerous virus. And like you just said, there's this paradox of places that have vaccinated quickly and are wealthy and have access to those vaccines going back to normal and discussing when do we get to take off masks. And that paradox is completely out of sync with what's going on in so many places in this world. This is a highly deadly virus, but beyond that, health systems matter. So places where health systems aren't equipped to manage this load, don't have the oxygen, don't have the capacity, the fatality rate of this infection is going to be higher. And I'm not surprised, I'm sad, but I'm not surprised that the death toll, as the WHO said, is likely much higher, 13,000 a day.
You touched on, of course, what we know is the way out of this pandemic, which are these life-saving vaccines. What role should U.S. and U.S. policymakers play in trying to accelerate the spread of those vaccines globally?
Yes, you know, you're exactly right. The only way we can get out of this is vaccines, and we actually have the solution. We have it. And I think that the United States can play a role in four ways. I think that we want to go back to being that global health leader, that we have played that role so often in the past. And the four ways really are something that we've already done, which is for the future, work with the WTO to temporarily waive vaccine patents. This has already been signaled that the Biden administration supports this. Other countries aren't signing on. It's important for them to keep on pushing on that, or the U.S., because this is for the future for countries that are not yet in trouble. For what countries that are in trouble right now, we need to donate or loan doses. And we do have excess doses. In fact, I wrote a piece in The Atlantic with others, and many people have echoed this, that our young, our kids in this country could even wait to get their doses of vaccine to help people who are much, much more likely to get severe disease in other countries. And we do have surplus doses. Duke has actually estimated we have 300 million surplus doses. So though I appreciate the 20 million doses that President Biden signaled the other day, plus 60 million AstraZeneca, we have more than that. Third is that pharmaceutical companies should use philanthropy. This is a global health crisis. They will make money. They should use philanthropy. They should give doses. And I do believe the U.S. could help with urging them. And then fourth is the U.S. global role as convening the UN in terms of global manufacturing and really, along with the WHO, figuring out how to get vaccines immediately into places that are surging and later into places that are likely to surge.
I want to touch back on one of those points that you made, which is the Biden administration supporting temporarily waiving the patent rights for these vaccines. You wrote recently that back in the 1990s during the HIV/AIDS epidemic, that adherence to patent rights killed millions of people in sub-Saharan Africa. Do you think in this debate we have given too much credence to pharmaceutical companies' arguments about this?
Yes, we have, because what I wrote about was that as an HIV doctor, I saw from 1996 to 2001 and even all the way to 2005 arguments about whether we should temporarily waive patents while millions died in sub-Saharan Africa of AIDS and people who are living with HIV in US and Europe had access to life-saving medications. The disparity was so great, and the arguments went on for so long, years and years, while people were dying. And finally, a lawsuit actually was filed by pharmaceutical companies against South Africa because they were purchasing cheaper drugs from India. India, who provided antiretroviral therapy to the world, who's now in trouble. And that lawsuit got so much international pressure to drop that the pharmaceutical companies dropped it, and it was recognized that this was terribly important, that if we have access to these medications, we can't let people die in other places. So yes, we have to work on vaccine patent waivers now, because if sub-Saharan Africa right now isn't hurting, they will. COVID will eventually get everyone, it will come to every country until we can get them vaccinated.
All right, Dr. Monica Gandhi, UC San Francisco, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The high-stakes court battle between Apple and Epic Games, the maker of Fortnite, one of the world's most popular video games, is nearing an end. And today featured an important moment. Apple CEO Tim Cook took the stand to defend the company's App Store against charges that it's grown into a monopoly. Lisa Desjardins has a look at the antitrust trial that could have big implications for Apple, other smartphones, and apps.
Amna, this was the first time Tim Cook has ever taken the witness stand in a courtroom. The battle first started in August of last year when Epic announced it added a new direct payment plan that gave Fortnite players the option to purchase virtual currency from Epic's payment system rather than from Apple. Apple takes a 30% cut of any app sale on its devices. Fortnite was soon pulled from the App Store, leaving millions of gamers unable to update the popular video game for new releases on their iPhones. Epic alleges that Apple's policies stifle competition and violate antitrust laws. But in court, Cook said there's plenty of competition from rivals, and he also said allowing developers to use their own in-app payment plans could expose customers to, quote, fraud issues. To unpack all of this for us, I'm joined by Reuters reporter Stephen Nellis. Stephen, we've got two huge factors in American culture, Apple and gamers, going at it. But tell us, what's at stake for Apple, but also for folks who just have regular iPhones?
What's at stake here is really what makes Apple a $2 billion company. If you think back to when the iPhone was released more than 10 years ago, the big difference versus the PCs of the time was what people called the walled garden, this idea that you can only install the software on there that Apple distributes to you through the App Store. And as we know, Android came along a little bit later and followed suit with that same model. So it's really set the bar for the entire mobile phone industry. One of the features of that for Apple is that if you want to be inside the walled garden as a software developer, you pay a 30% commission. And that has created what is just the anchor of this $54 billion services business for Apple, a big part of what's powered their profits and a big part of what's set the expectations for everybody's smartphone today.
$54 billion for Apple. Fortnite and Epic Games are leading this rebellion here. Some folks might remember last year, Epic Games made this move, launching this ad that was sort of mocking or turning around Apple's own iconic 1984 ad. In this case, it was a game character launching a sword at the Apple image itself. But, you know, beyond this idea of good guys and bad guys, really the legal case, it seems to me, is coming down to the idea of, what does Apple do? Is it a device company, or is it a games and app company? And is it a monopoly? Can you help us understand those arguments?
So that's right, Lisa. I think it's really important to distinguish two things here. First is the actual trial that's at hand here. And as you say, that does hinge on actually some fairly arcane and technical legal issues. Mainly, the first thing you have to decide whether you call somebody a monopoly or not is, what is the market that we're talking about? And Epic, in this case, is making an argument that might sound a little strange to a lot of people. Epic is arguing Apple has such a strong lock on its customers that those 1 billion iPhone users in the world are basically their own separate market. And by definition, that means Apple has a monopoly over that market because it controls all the software that goes onto the phone. Now, Apple wants to frame things differently. First off, as Tim Cook said today, they feel that they compete vigorously against Android phones from Samsung, lots of brands in China. Remember, Apple's a global company, so Xiaomi and phones that people might buy there. And then more to the point, Apple is saying, well, wait a minute, this case is about video games and about where you can pay to play Fortnite. And they're also trying to make the argument that in this particular case, they face plenty of competition because gamers can and do go play Fortnite on their Xbox or their PlayStation or on their gaming PC rig and can pay for those payments there. So that's all what this legal case is about. But what I think is important is to remember that that's separate from the larger discussion about antitrust issues and technology platforms. So legal experts have said that Epic has an uphill battle here in the case, but what this is doing is generating a lot of record in the court documents and the testimony that Tim Cook is giving today that U.S. Congress, that lawmakers in Europe are going to look at and decide, wait a minute, you know, maybe what Apple is doing is within the bounds of current antitrust law, but what if we want to change those antitrust laws? What if we want to enact reform? And so that's the bigger battle here that's not just totally encapsulated in the specific case at hand.
Ruthie, what do you think Tim Cook wanted to do on the stand? Apple called him itself.
That's right. So they very much wanted Tim Cook to get up there and make the case that all these rules and restrictions that Apple places on developers are all in the service of the privacy, security, and safety of Apple's customer base. Tim Cook said it on the stand many times today. He said, this is not about money. This is all about the user and the experience. They want a phone that just works. They don't want bugs and malware and other bad software that crashes their phone. They want something that's reliable and that they feel like they can hand to their children and know that all the software that's going to be on there is going to be safe and secure and appropriate for those children. And that's important for a couple of reasons. Number one, that's definitely Apple's defense in the broader public sphere. And number two, it's also actually important for a legal reason in this case, because under current antitrust law, even if you have a monopoly, if you charge high prices, if you can show that some of the restrictions you put on one side of a two-sided marketplace, like developers trying to get to the iPhone customer, if you can show that it has some real benefits for the customers on the other side of it, the courts have said, you know, sometimes that can be okay. So it had an important rhetorical function and an important legal function as well.
Okay. Reuters' Stephen Nevis will keep following this case. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lisa.
From the impact of the Mideast ceasefire on U.S. policy to a potential commission looking into the January 6th Capitol attack, it's a good time for the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, columnist for The Washington Post. Good to see you both. Welcome back. Happy Friday. David, I want to start with you. The president was just speaking at the White House, actually, and was asked about this latest ceasefire, asked also if there's been a shift in Democratic Party politics when it comes to the approach in Israel. This is what what he had to say. There is no shift in my commitment to the security of Israel, period. David, what do you make of the way the president has handled these last 11 days and this ceasefire?
I think he's handled it pretty well. He's kept the U.S. out of being the center of the story. He's learned from some of the mistakes we made in 2014, ending that Gaza war. He was pressured to lean on Bibi and Israel to do the ceasefire or to condemn them publicly. But if he does that, then Bibi has to push back, so it actually delays the ceasefire, just so Bibi can show his independence. And if he does that, Hamas thinks, oh, Israel, U.S. is leaning on Israel, so Hamas gets more aggressive. So this was a case in which being a little passive and doing things in private was much more effective than they would have been to do anything in public. And so I think the administration was wise, basically, to handle it as they did.
Jonathan, he was asked that question, though, because there's been growing pressure from within the party, right, from progressives like Bernie Sanders and others to do more in the way of standing up for the human rights of Palestinians. But if you take a quick look at where the country is today, I want to point to some quick numbers we looked up from Gallup. This is from a February poll, so it's before this latest conflict. But it does show that 75% of Americans do have a favorable opinion of Israel. That is up in the last 20 years by 10 points. That same poll, though, when you're looking at the number of people saying who they think the U.S. should put more pressure on, 35% now think that the U.S. should put more pressure on Israel. That number is also up. 44% say they should put more pressure on Palestinians. Are you seeing any of that, Jonathan, show up in the Biden approach?
Well, I think I would love to see what a poll would show today. I think that the bombing, the Israeli Air Defense Forces bombing of that high-rise building in Gaza that also housed international news organizations was a pivot point in all of this, where the private conversations that were happening took on even more urgency and then forced the president to go even more public in terms of putting pressure on the Israeli government to do something to curb the violence. But when it comes to the Democratic Party and the forces pulling back and forth, I bring up that pivot point because Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey, who is the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, is known in Washington as being a stalwart ally, if you will, within the United States Senate, supporter of Israel and Israel's right to defend itself. After that bombing of that building in Gaza, Senator Menendez put out a statement that caught the White House by surprise and a lot of people by surprise by condemning or raising very serious questions about what Israel had done. And so I think that made it possible for President Biden to be a little more, how shall we say, forceful in his conversations with Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Well, David, let me ask you more broadly about President Biden's approach, not just on this one issue. You had a good chunk of time to sit down with him for a fascinating interview. It's the subject of your latest column that's called Has Biden Changed? He Tells Us. And in it, you write right at the top, what happened to Joe Biden? Many people thought he was a moderate incrementalist, but now he's promoting whopping big legislative packages that make many on the progressive left extremely happy. The answer seems to be it's complicated. David, tell us about that conversation with him. How is it complicated?
Oh,
I believe we have lost the connection with David Brooks. We will try to get him back in just a moment. In the meantime, Jonathan, let me bring you back in here. You have certainly read this column. It's a long assessment of where President Biden is and faces this criticism of no longer being a moderate incrementalist, many accuse him of. What do you make of it?
Well, David's column was terrific in being able to sit down with the president, particularly this president, who, you know, he wears everything on his sleeve. You know, I've been on a phone call between the president and, you know, opinion writers, including David, so I can pretty much imagine how that conversation went. Look, I think President Biden is sort of the man who is meeting the moment. A lot of people wonder, you know, whether progressives have pulled the party farther to the left or pushing the party farther to the left. And I counter that. And I think President Biden, by doing what he's doing, it's really that the party is catching up to the country. You tick off any issue and ask where the American people are. And let's just take raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. The American people want that done. The Democratic Party has been pushing for that for a long time. The president now, the president of the United States, Joe Biden, is pushing for that. And so the beauty of David's column, and what I loved about it, is that it takes sort of the policy issues that we're talking about now, whether it's the American Jobs Act, the American Jobs Plan, the Families Plan, the American Rescue Plan, and broadens it out in the way that only that David famously does, to the 35,000 foot level, and shows that Joe Biden, it's the last line in the column, Joe Biden hasn't changed. It's just that he's gone bigger. The price tags on these things that he's pushing have gone bigger than what he pushed for when he was in the Senate for 36 years. The policies that he championed when he was vice president with President with President Obama. So I don't know if it's right to call President Biden incrementalist. I think he is incrementalist when it suits his purposes to get something done right away. But I think if you look at everything that he's trying to do, he's going big. And he's going big because the problems facing the country are large, but also he views it through the international prism, which I think David puts in his column because of his time on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, that the problems that America is facing, they are impacting not just America at home, but America standing abroad.
For anyone wondering why David Brooks isn't weighing in on his own column, we just lost the connection with him. We are trying to bring him back into the conversation, and we'll do so as soon as that connection is reestablished. But Jonathan, while I have you, I also wanted to talk about this vote on the potential commission to look into the January 6th Capitol attack. There was a proposal that came before the House. They voted on it. It passed there. 35 Republicans joined Democrats to back that commission. Did that number surprise you?
Well, I'm not, here's the thing that surprised me. It's what surprises me is that it was only 35. Leave aside the politics of everything of why it was just 35. This the January 6th Commission should not be a partisan issue. This should be a patriotism issue. What happened on that day was horrifying. People trying to rush the Capitol, invading the Capitol, while the United States Congress was certifying a free and fair and legitimate small d Democratic election, certifying the election and making it official that Joe Biden would be the president of the United States. Those people tried to stop that. The people who voted against the commission, the other Republicans who voted against the commission, they were there that day. How they could not vote to approve in a commission that would look into what happened so that we find out what happened, but also so that we can learn things that we could do to ensure that it doesn't happen again. The fact that they voted, only 35 Republicans voted for it, I think is a shame.
I need to ask you as well, Jonathan, because this is right now with the Senate, 10 Republicans there would need to back it for that commission to move forward. Do you see that happening?
I'm really having a hard time seeing that happening. I mean, if memory serves, 7 Republicans voted with the Democrats to vote to convict then President, well, at that point, he was former President Trump during impeachment. I don't see where the other 3 votes to get to 10 come from. That's assuming that those 7 vote for the commission.
Jonathan Capehart joining us tonight. I apologize to David Brooks. Tonight's Brooks and Capehart is mostly just Capehart, but Jonathan, it's always good to talk to you. Thanks for being
here.
Great
to see you too. Thanks.
Well, even as the pandemic shows some signs of easing in the United States, the number of deaths does continue to climb, even if slower than before. Each Friday, we've been honoring some of the incredible lives lost during the pandemic. Here tonight are 5 more.
Bob Costello served as the fire chief for the fast-growing city of Buckeye, Arizona, for more than a dozen years. As the city expanded, the department, with Bob at the helm, expanded with it. Even then, a coworker said, the 62-year-old was always keen to connect with colleagues and residents in person, whether it was to field their questions or just say hello. Bob was also a car buff, a passion that began early in life, and he was quick to reach out to friends when they were going through struggles, his wife told us. He'd always take the time to make sure they were okay. There were three things that defined the life of 64-year-old Bernita Elaine Rayford Kershaw. Family, church, and the New York Police Department, her daughter said. A lifelong New Yorker, Bernita dedicated 30 years to the NYPD, first as a police administrative aide and then as an investigator. She took great pride in her job and enjoyed helping friends, relatives, and even strangers find careers within the department. Described by her loved ones as silly, vivacious, and resilient, Bernita was a loving partner to her soulmate Edwin and a devoted mother and grandmother. Serving and celebrating the Native American community in Chicago gave Angel Salas a sense of pride and purpose, said his son. The 70-year-old elder was a healer and a recognized chief of the Lakota tribe. A Vietnam Army veteran, Angel cared deeply about honoring other Native vets for their service. He helped organize annual gatherings of vets from various tribes across the country, finding solace and friendship through their shared experiences. His loved ones said Angel was a giving man who would be the first in line to help anyone in need. Angel shared his love of Native traditions with his 9 children. Throughout her life, 89-year-old Jane Spear Brooke relished seeking out new challenges. Around the time the first of her children left for college, she returned to school as well, earning both her bachelor's and master's degrees while in her 40s. Jane also took up skiing at 57. And over the years, the active church and hospital volunteer from Georgia proved to be a prolific gardener. She passed on her love of plants and flowers to her 5 children and her many grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Above all, retired Lieutenant Colonel John Sloan aspired to a career in service, his brother said. It's why the former munitions officer and Vietnam veteran joined the U.S. Air Force and stayed for more than 2 decades. It was also why John, when he retired from the force, made a second career as a university development officer. The 76-year-old especially enjoyed catching up with his brothers at family functions. One brother described John as fun-loving, optimistic, and, quote, always looking on the bright side.
As always, we want to say thank you to all of the families who share these stories with us. And we want to note that John Sloan, who you just heard about, was a brother of one of our board members here at WETA, where the show is produced. It's another reminder that this pandemic has touched so many of us in some way over this last year. Well, the Women's National Basketball Association is celebrating a milestone this week, its 25th anniversary. The WNBA has fought not only for national recognition of its athletes, but it's long been at the forefront of the racial justice movement and the fight for LGBTQ rights. The league has faced its share of financial hurdles, but the WNBA continues to prove its resilience and relevance. The 2020 season was dedicated to Breonna Taylor. Players also took a united stand against former Republican Senator Kelly Loeffler, who co-owned Georgia's Atlanta Dream Team, and criticized the league's support for the Black Lives Matter movement. To explore the league's successes and hardships, I'm joined by Sue Bird of the champion Seattle Storm. She has won 4 titles in the league and is an 11-time All-Star. Sue Bird, I am so excited to say this. Welcome to the NewsHour, and thank you for being here. This is going to be your 18th season in the league. You have played more minutes and more games than anyone else. 25 years this week for the league. What does this moment mean to you?
It's pretty special. I think for myself, it's just really exciting both to know that I've been able to play this long, but also that I've been able to see the league grow. And right now it really feels like there's a turning point in a good way happening. There's some momentum being built surrounding our league. You mentioned it, the work we've done off the court has spoken for itself, but the work we've been doing on the court also speaks for itself. So it's super exciting.
We should say you've been playing this long and you've been straight killing it for this long, all those titles, and you guys are defending champions, we should mention too. And the league has come a very long way, right? The viewership has grown steadily year over year. There have been some landmark deals when it comes to pay increases and paid maternity leave. And as we mentioned, you guys have led the way when it comes to all the pro leagues, really, taking a stance for social and racial justice. Why do you think that is? Why do you think the WNBA has been able to lead in that way?
I think it's just a product of a couple of things. One being the makeup of our league. You know, I think when you look at the percentages, we have a high percentage of Black women in our league. We have a high percentage who are in the LGBTQ community. These are things that we live. And then, of course, we're women. So these are things that we live every day, you know, being marginalized in different ways. So that doesn't, you know, that doesn't leave us just because we put a basketball uniform and start playing a game. So I think it's just in our DNA a little bit. But what we've also found is through our time as basketball players trying to, you know, get a professional league going, trying to make it successful, we've encountered a lot of different things there. And sometimes I joke that, you know, people say shut up and dribble. Well, we wanted to. We actually wanted to be basketball players and to be judged for our play on the court. But it seems like everybody likes to talk about all the other things that surround our league, that our uniform should be tighter, or we should look more feminine. So I think through that, I guess, journey with this league, we developed a little bit of a backbone. And now not only do we stand up for ourselves, but we love to extend our voice to others as well.
You guys have lived through the pandemic in the same way the rest of the country and the world has too for the last year. You played last season in that bubble. This next season is bubble-less. Is there any concern about that? Are you worried at all about going back to some version of a new normal?
Yes and no. I mean, I think at times, you know, when, you know, we're starting to travel now, so we're taking commercial flights and we're in airports, and it can be a little alarming at first to see people without masks. But simultaneously, I think our league has actually done a tremendous job of educating our members, our players, on the vaccine. And, you know, I don't have an exact percentage for you, but I'm pretty sure that our league is going to be pretty close to being 100% vaccinated. And that right there, you know, calms my nerves. I think not only have we educated ourselves in order to get that needle in our arm, we're also willing to help educate others and hopefully instill some vaccination confidence in some people who might be on the fence. So that gives me great confidence heading into this season that we're going to be able to play safely.
This last COVID season also revealed that a lot of the same gaps that persist in the rest of society absolutely still exist in pro sports. We talked about reduced games for the WNBA, worse facilities than the men's league. And of course, women still make a smaller percentage of the league revenue than the men do. At this point, 25 years into the league, what do you think it will take next to close some of those gaps?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of people like to compare us to the men, and I understand why. I actually try not to fall into that trap. I think the NBA is incredibly successful for a lot of reasons. Some of those reasons are investment. We haven't gotten that investment. We haven't gotten, you know, the corporate sponsorship investment. We haven't gotten the media coverage. These are facts. You know, I think it's something like we get 4% of media coverage. So to me, when you think of the first 25 years of the WNBA, and then maybe think of like the what hopefully is the next into our 50th year, we just haven't been invested in. So to me, it's like, what a great investment. We're hanging on as it is, and we're doing well, and the product on the court is getting better and better without the investment. So imagine what would happen, you know, from zero if you just go up to one or two or three or something, you know, and you get something in that investment category. It can only do better. So that excites me.
As we mentioned, you and the Seattle Storm are kicking off this season as defending champs. Care to make a prediction? Is it back-to-back?
Man, back-to-back is hard. Back-to-back is hard. You don't see it often. There's a reason. It's really hard when you have that target on your back. Of course, I'm going to say that I think we're going to win, but I also know that it is up for grabs. We had a lot of turnover on our roster, so we're a new team, just like a lot of teams, trying to put it all together. So I guess you'll have to tune in. You'll have to tune in and see what happens.
You'll have to tune in. That's a great message for everyone out there. Sue Bird of the champion Seattle Storm as the WNBA marks 25 years. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Well, next week marks the one-year anniversary of George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis. His death at the hands of police touched off global protests and a worldwide artistic response. Special correspondent Fred DeSam-Lazaro reports from Minneapolis. It's part of our series, Race Matters, America After George Floyd, and our ongoing arts and culture coverage, Canvas.
On plywood and sidewalks, brick walls and windows, creative expressions from this year of racial reckoning now envelop the city that sparked a movement.
In the days following his death, George Floyd's image became an icon around the world. Here in the city of Minneapolis, there's been an explosion of public art featuring Floyd's face, his last words, and on a broader theme of racial justice.
Artist Peyton Scott Russell grew up near 38th Street and Chicago Avenue in South Minneapolis, the intersection where George Floyd was killed on May 25th, 2020. Peyton remembers the first time he watched the video of Floyd's death.
I just kept seeing my father's face on George's face. I thought I was alone in how I felt, the anger that I felt in that moment. And I was just, I wanted to go out and physically protest. And then I had a few people tell me that I had a stronger voice than to go out and physically protest, which was my art voice as a street artist.
So Peyton got to work on what would become one of the most recognized depictions of George Floyd, a 12-foot black and white mural that, for the past year, has been perched just above the spot where Floyd drew his last breath.
There were times that I was weeping painting the picture, and I had to take breaks. And, you know, seeing that face that large and painting it that way with that black and white was really profound to me as I painted it. My original thought was I was going to install this at night as an act of street art anonymously and paint Mr. Floyd's face as large as I could as a way to say, look what you did, you know, look, just put it somewhere that was just really intrusive as an obstacle. My first idea was to bolt it into the middle of the street on the intersection of 38th in Chicago.
But Peyton realized a stiff breeze could knock the mural over or it could be taken by the city. So he arrived at 38th in Chicago, and a group of about 30 people, some strangers, helped bolt it to the bus shelter where it sits today.
I've been contacted to give permission to use that piece in a number of backgrounds and stories, and I've been really careful about, am I really morally that person to say yes or no, who can use this and who can't? Because I painted it for the community, and I needed to let it go and let the community own it. And that's what really street art is all about.
Over the past 12 months, countless pieces have been left at the intersection now known as George Floyd Square. Posters and handwritten notes, flower bouquets, and drawings. Some have made their way here to a pop-up exhibition near the square called Still Here, Unstolen, Unbroken.
They were protest signs.
Janelle Austin is the lead caretaker. We spoke to her at the Say Their Names Cemetery, a makeshift memorial for black people killed by police. It's just steps from the exhibit.
I like to call it creative expressions of pain and hope instead of art. And really honoring the people who have laid offerings down first and foremost as protest and then also as public grief. Everything is somebody's offering, therefore nothing is thrown away.
Austin had a specific vision, remind people of the emotion during those early days of protest.
We are building a rememory. The space itself, the offerings themselves, calls people into a place where they remember where we were, they remember where they were, and they are then commissioned to continue the work of racial justice.
So it was kind of like an embrace that pulled people back to the time.
Exactly.
Austin hopes to eventually raise funds for a permanent space large enough to fit all these offerings, as well as a traveling exhibit. But she's been deliberate about the sources of that funding. She chose not to take money from the city of Minneapolis.
When I look at the story of the lynching of George Floyd, I see a city employee on city time that killed a man.
It's holding those two contradictions. It's saying,
can we trust you?
Gulgun Kayyem, the city's director of arts, culture, and the creative economy, says the killing of George Floyd broke down the trust it took years to build between the city, local artists, and underserved residents.
These are the literal communities we're in every day. Our work is at 38th in Chicago, and looking at what happened, it really was a sense of despair on my part in seeing all that hard work really disappear with the action of one person.
After Floyd's killing and the unrest, Kayyem's office repurposed $100,000 in grants for artists responding to the events. One went to Creatives After Curfew, a collective that painted a series of murals across the city. Minneapolis native Leslie Barlow is part of the group.
The murals that we started making, you know, of course, on one hand, were a way to process what was going on, a way to grieve in community, and to also share these particular stories and messages. But also, it was a way to heal and connect with each other, because watching or hearing about George Floyd's murder in isolation, right, when we had all been separate for a couple months, you know, at that point with the pandemic, was incredibly difficult. You didn't even have to talk, actually, right? Like, even just the act of painting, processing in that way can be very healing for some people, and, you know, speaking for myself.
And with messages of solidarity, black liberation, police abolition, Barlow says who created the murals mattered.
We were seeing a lot of non-black artists taking up a lot of space. That really ignited something in me. If it's a movement for black lives, those folks should be able to tell their own stories.
Barlow says there were challenges in deciding where to paint, too.
Something I saw last summer was businesses using black trauma as a way to protect their property, right? So they are putting up boards, asking artists to come do murals, and don't actually align with the messages that are in the murals. It's a very performative act.
So you think that some businesses were commissioning artists to make murals so that their businesses wouldn't be attacked if there was unrest?
Oh, absolutely. That was happening, yeah, all over.
1 year later, Barlow sees a dual purpose in the work.
I hope that the murals now are both, yeah, an archive of that time, but also a kind of liberatory space where people can strive for the messages, right, that are being portrayed.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Fred DeSamlazaro in Minneapolis.
And Fred's reporting is a partnership with the Undertold Stories Project at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. Now, as we've said, next week marks 1 year since George Floyd was killed. But what's changed in this year of protests and national racial reckoning? On Tuesday night, we hope you will join us for an hour-long special on PBS. It's called Race Matters, America After George Floyd.
In a year of racial reckoning, violence, abuse, and inequities persist.
We, the jury, find the defendant guilty.
The Chauvin verdict hinted at a path to justice. Yet much more is to be done.
Now's the time to act.
How can we create lasting change? Race Matters. America After George Floyd. A PBS NewsHour special report. Tuesday, May 25th at 10 p.m., 9 central.
You can watch that special report here on your PBS station at 10 p.m. Eastern and join the conversation by following the NewsHour online. And don't forget to stay right here with PBS tonight. You'll want to tune in to catch Yamiche Alcindor and her panel of wonderful journalists on Washington Week. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz. Thank you for joining us. Please stay safe and have a good weekend.